out will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have an interview with a top NPC competitor, Gerard Dante, who was around in the pretty much the early 90s, the late 1980s. And he competed against really top bodybuilders at that time, like Paul DeMeo, Kevin Lavroni, Ronnie Coleman when he was in the Nationals, Flex Wheeler. And Gerard was, for years, trying to get his pro card. He never did accomplish that goal. But he went on and became a supplement owner, and he owns a supplement company called MHP. And I think he was one of the first bodybuilders to go out and run a successful supplement company that's been going on, I think, for 20, 30 years now. So we have an interview with Gerard coming up where he talks about how he got into bodybuilding and then his transition from playing football in high school over to competing. And he was a very good bodybuilder right off the bat, winning Teenage Nationals his first time out. And he actually beat Chris Cormier at that show. So Gerard's going to tell us about his story in a second. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn body fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number out here in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939. They'll work with anybody in the continental United States. You don't have to be out here in Tampa. Or you can go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, flalternativemeds.com. And mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll also give you 20% off your first order. All right. So how are you guys doing out there in the world? These COVID cases, of course, are picking up. It's getting pretty intense out here in Florida. I work at a hospital, and we are getting more and more people in the ICU beds out here. So don't know what's going to happen. In the bodybuilding world, you know, we've got the Mr. Olympia set up for the end of December, December 16th through 20th out in Las Vegas. So everybody's hoping that goes off. Out here in Tampa, we've got the Tampa Pro coming up on August 1st. Tim Gardner, who's a friend of mine, is a promoter, and he said it's going to happen no matter what. He said the hotel is behind him where he's having the competition, the Hyatt. So it looks like that's going to happen. I don't know if they're going to have an audience, if they're going to let everybody in or not. So this last weekend out in Tampa, Florida, we had a Mr. Olympia seminar with Brendan Curry, who is the new Mr. Olympia. And he was there with Erin Stern, who trains at Powerhouse Gym. She was, of course, a figure Olympia champion, I think three or four times. And now she is back competing in the IFBB. And they also had Derek Lunsford, who was second in the Olympia 212 class. This kid has got a great physique. Everybody says this guy's got unbelievable potential. Really, really big and small waist, unbelievable front double bicep. And he's super nice kid. I talked to him quite a few times because he trains several times out here at the Powerhouse, as well as some other gyms out here in Tampa. So anyways, Brandon Curry and Erin Stern and Derek Lunsford all had a seminar just this last weekend on Saturday at the Powerhouse Gym Athletic Club where I train. And I guess that went along really well. I had to work. I wasn't able to go. But Brandon Curry's looking really big. So everybody's hoping the Olympia happens, and we're looking forward to that Tampa Pro. It's the Tampa Pro, I think they call it. Should be a good show, and they have a big amateur division as well. All right, last week's show with the 1980 Mr. Olympia interviews, as you can imagine, was very, very well received. I got a lot of comments. It seems like every time we do anything with the 1980 Mr. Olympia, it just gets a ton of comments. That was 40 years ago this year, and it's still one of the most talked about Mr. Olympias ever. I remember when I used to go on Iron Age when Sean Perrine ran that website, the late Sean Perrine. He used to run it in the early 2000s, I think around 2002, 2003, and I used to go on there all the time. And this was before the internet really took off, before we had YouTube or Facebook. So I used to go on the forums there, and every time we had a discussion about the 1980 Mr. Olympia, the thread would go on for like 20, 30 pages. It was just, that's like a contest you can't stop talking about. So let me read some of the comments I got here, and I also got some emails. This was on my Facebook page. Nicholas Daver said, probably the most difficult Mr. Olympia to make a decision in. Arnold is way off his best, but better than most of the others. Frank Zane is below his best. Tom Platz is nowhere near his best self in 81. Boyer Coe has the best waist development of his life. Chris Dickerson is a year ahead of his horrendous elbow development. And Roy Callender has mass but narrow clavicles compared to Samir and Dennis Tenorino. It's certainly not easy to pick the number one, and I feel we should feel compassion for the judges. The easy explanation is corruption, but is it? Richard Bronger said, I think Mike Mentzer deserved a better placing. Dan Burt said, I kind of agree with Jack Neary's summation of the 80 contest. Arnold at 90% of his best was still better than the rest, and he was a deserving winner. Now, 81 was another story altogether. And then Rick Wayne chimed in. Rick Wayne's been making comments on these bodybuilding stories lately. And Rick said, where did Jack write that? And Dan said, let me say that you are my all-time favorite bodybuilding writer. Secondly, my issue of Muscle and Fitness covering the 80 Olympia is long gone, but I believe Jack Neary wrote that contest review. And then Peter McGuff pulled it up. The beginning of Jack Neary's article about the 80 Olympia said Arnold Schwarzenegger's comeback resulted in his seventh Olympia victory, but many expert observers felt his victory was a miscarriage of justice and a setback for the sport. How many times had the rumor been dredged up? How long had it drifted aimlessly through the gossip wards of bodybuilding like some sun-baked tumbleweed rolling down a windswept road to nowhere? How often had gym walls echoed the anticipation of Arnold Schwarzenegger's return from retirement? And how often had Arnold himself told us, no, no, 1,000 times no, he was out to pasture to stay? And Rick said, wasn't that worth a second look? Thank you, Peter, a whole bunch. Joe Amaro said, amazing podcast, John Hansen, the best thing after the magazine era. Fabian Goh said, Arnold wasn't at his best, but he was still better than everybody else. That's why he won. David Nanelli Jr. said, absolutely amazing. And Jose Palacio said, the more you listen to the interviews with the judges and the former competitors, the more it smells like corruption. What could have been if 1980 and 81 Olympias were not fixed? Biceps only and clowning around wins one show, and a one-legged man with breast tissue wins the other. On my Bodybuilding Legends page on Facebook, Scott Barron said, it's a coin toss between the 80 and 81 Olympia for being the most controversial of all time. However, since the 1980 Mr. Olympia regarded Arnold, I'll go along with it being the most controversial. I can't wait to listen to this. All right, so that was it for my comments on my Facebook page. On the YouTube page, because I did make a YouTube video of this, and if you guys want to check that out, my YouTube page is just under John Hansen, so check that out. Crazy said, I remember reading a few years ago that Arnold said he has regretted competing in 1980, and it was a mistake on his part. Jeff Govern said, for several years in a row, the O was won by men with relatively small legs, but at that time, Arnold was bigger than the sport. His star was on the rise. Jack said, Arnold was the best man at Paul Graham's wedding. Odessa File said, thanks, John. What is interesting is that Coe, Dickerson, Zane, Walker, Callender, Benute did not say they should have won, but that Arnold should not have placed higher than 5th to 9th. There is a general consensus that Zane, Coe, Mentzer, or Dickerson should have won. Then you have another group, including Walker, Callender, Tenorino, who looked better than Arnold. Even the guys who placed quite low, such as Padilla, Duval, Emmett, Viador, Benute, were arguably in better shape or more proportional. I'm unsure how Waller would have placed. I think Walker said it best. Arnold is wearing a stolen watch. I had seen Coe, Zane, Dickerson, Tenorino, Ray Mentzer, who was taller but not as freakier as Mike, compete and guest pose from 1979 to 1981. They all looked better than Arnold. The corruption in the IFBB was incredible, as described by Roger Walker, Boyer Coe, Zane, etc. The honest Dennis Stallard was discharged. Serge Nubre was discarded. a criminal, and Arnold Buddy was promoting the contest. The other judges could be bought or swayed. Shaq said Arnold's relationship with Paul Graham is documented and on the web. No wonder Roger Walker didn't want to expand upon it. Brian said, I cannot get enough of the 1980 and 81 Olympia. Thanks for the great content, John. Madden said, for Arnold, the 1980 Olympia was not worth what he lost. Jerry said, perhaps your best show ever. I love the 80 and 81 Olympia contest. So many guys came in their best condition, and yet controversial decisions tarnished both shows. First, in my opinion, Arnold and Franco did the sport a disservice by competing in those shows. Both well below their best should have stayed away. They put everyone involved in those shows in compromised positions. Secondly, if they got what they deserved, they both would have done no better than fifth place. Yet the other guys in both shows look so good that they are my favorite bodybuilders of all time. I have Iron Man magazines from both of those shows, and they have the greatest pictures of these men ever. Too bad the selfish egos of Arnold and Franco had to interfere. Plandemic said, I would have paid to see Arnold and Mike come to blows. That would make great drama. Kurt Vonnegut said, wow, Roger Walker, wow. Yeah, Roger Walker was pretty outspoken in those interviews. Jason said, I think the general consensus is that Mike Mentzer almost kicked Arnold's ass and Arnold almost shit his pants. The Spritz said, Chris Dickerson's memory of that night must be fading as per the witnesses. Quote, among the competing bodybuilders, Chris Dickerson, who finished second, ran out of the theater when the contest ended and disappeared into the night. Reasoning behind this is that he was not expected to place so high. Maybe he feared retaliation. Card Warp said, fantastic. Thanks, John. Dark Solara said, hey, John, anywhere I can find the links or anything pertaining to his comment about Once Upon a Time in Australia article? I can't find anything anywhere. I'd really love to read that. No, I have not read that article, and I have not found it either. I looked on the internet. I've Googled it several times. He said it was from a magazine or something called Iron Brothers, but I cannot find it either. I did read John Fair's article about Arnold, and that was pretty well documented and very long, and you can find that on Google. Stephen Roberts said, I can always rely on bodybuilders who lost to be objective in their views. Lone Mapper said, put Chris Dickerson's mindset in Mentzer's head, and Mentzer would have won 3 to 5 Olympias. Billy Johnson said, great video. Shanaz said, John, you and Boyer look like brothers. Okay. This one says, John, if you see Arnold's pics at the 80 Olympia, he only had a 4-pack when posing abs. Yeah, his ab shot was not his best shot, that's for sure. Conrad Murray said they should cut and make that film. Spritz said, 1981 Mr. O, Roy Callender looked far better. Either him or Tom Platz would have saved the show by winning. Madden said, 81, where the guy with one leg wins. Best comments of all these champions. Dazzer said, Arnold should be challenged on film about that show because he is more than vocal about what he perceives to be social injustices as of his politics today. He should not get a free pass on it, especially as so many of the athletes think it was rigged. This comment says, Boyer Co. is wrong. Arnold was still the biggest with the best arms, chest, and shoulders. All the other competitors had smaller frames and did not look as impressive. Look closely at pictures. The other men being shorter with smaller bone structures didn't help. Plus, by the night show and all that posing, Arnold looked harder. All right, so that was my comments on YouTube. And I did also get quite a few emails this week. So if you guys want to email me directly, my email address is naturalolympia@gmail.com. And if you listen to the show on Apple iTunes, please go to the Apple iTunes page and rate our show. Give it 5 stars if you like it, and you can also leave a comment there. Oh, by the way, Pat Comer sent me an article that I'm going to read right after we get done with Gerard Dante's interview. And it is an article from Sports Illustrated in 1974 where they actually covered the 1974 Mr. Olympia. So I had the Sports Illustrated article where they did an article about bodybuilding, and this was right before the 74 Olympia. But I did not know that they actually covered the 74 Olympia. So it's a shorter article, and Pat sent me the page that he photocopied it and sent it to me. So I'm going to read that right after we get done with our interview with Gerard Dante. So make sure you stick around for that at the end because it was really, really cool. I thought it was so cool that Sports Illustrated covered bodybuilding back in the mid-70s. It just goes to show you how bodybuilding was fascinating to the mass media back then before it really got discovered. And 74 was also the year that the book Pumping Iron came out, and it came out right around the time of the 74 Olympia. I think it was like the week before the show or the week after the show. It came out that fall. All right, and Pat sent us an email, and he said, excellent show. We've all been in shows where the outcome is sketchy. John Grimmick probably shouldn't have beaten Steve Reeves. Bodybuilding would have been more interesting if it sold itself as an art and it had muscle shows rather than competitions. And then he said, here's an article from Sports Illustrated from October 23rd, 1974 issue, 1 week after the Men in the Myth issue. I always wondered how many years Arnold could have won the Olympia if he continued to improve on his condition in the 74 Olympia. Phil Griffin said, hi, John, your interviews lately have been outstanding. I love the two on Mensur. I just wanted to suggest that you do a show on Serge Nubre. There is very little written on him due to his strained relationship he had with the Weeders. I think Jerry or Peter would have some knowledge of his training and diet. Yeah, I think Jerry would probably have a lot of knowledge about Serge Nubre because I think he saw him when he was training at Gold's Gym. He says, keep up the good work. You are definitely the best bodybuilding historian out there. This one is from Andrew Heffernan. And Andrew says, howdy, John. Congratulations on 3 years of podcasting. I really enjoyed the compilation of interviews about the 1980 Mr. Olympia. I had heard most of them already, but it was great to hear them back to back and get a fuller picture of those great athletes' take on that controversial show. After listening, I hunted around on YouTube for footage, and I found plenty. I assume you've seen Total Rebuild, Paul Graham's slanted documentary, with Arnold more or less parroting his own braggadocio from Pumping Iron. Graham seems to be trying to rewrite history. He cut the booze that your interviewees mentioned, showed almost no reaction to the results from the other athletes, and he generally made it seem the audience was delighted to see Arnold crowned again. Perhaps more informative is this amateur footage taken from the balcony by a fan named Norm Comich. Arnold still has his trademark chest, biceps, and calves, but he's not as sharp as most of the competitors, and his thighs look very thin. I'd love to hear your take on the results based on all the available footage. Did Arnold deserve the win? Thanks again for that great show. Yeah, I have obviously seen Total Rebuild. I think I even have it here. And you're right, they did definitely do some editing with the end. I noticed at the end when Arnold was announced the winner, they showed Arnold when he was doing his posing routine. They showed the audience when Arnold was doing his posing routine. And they show the audience, and they're obviously cheering because Arnold's out there posing. And then they go back to Arnold, and he walks off the stage. So that was his posing routine. But they made it seem like that was when he won. And, yeah, Roger Walker said the audience was booing like crazy. I've read other reports which said they were booing at first, and then people started cheering. And then I did also see that footage from Norm Comich. I have that on videotape, actually, because that was around when Iron Age was around back then. And I think somebody back then was selling it, and I bought it. So, yeah, you're right. Norm was from America, and I think he was on vacation in Australia. And he just decided to go see the contest. He didn't have tickets or anything, and they were able to get in. And they sat in the balcony, and he had his camera with him, and he took it. And it does give you a much different view looking from the balcony. Arnold's legs look really thin. So you could see if that's how Arnold's legs really look, that's why the show is really controversial. Because in some pictures, as Roy Duvall mentioned in our interview, he said Arnold looked much better in the pictures than he did in real life. What's amazing about that 1980 Olympia is Arnold does look good in the pictures, and you really could make a case for him winning. But when you talk to people that were there, I would say 90% of the people say that he shouldn't have won. So, and then there's also that CBS footage. If Arnold should have won, or if it was close where you could see he could have won, why did they refuse to show that footage? I mean, that says a lot right there. This email is from Dan Falcone. Dan says, I'm enjoying your Legends podcast immensely. May I suggest attempting to interview Dr. Ellington Darden and Bob Guida, two blasts from the past? Guida, I'm sure, could regale you about the old days at the Duncan YMCA training with the Myth. Keep up the great, inspiring work. I did interview Bob Guida. Bob, I know from Chicago, and he still lives out there. There was an interview. If you go under my website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and look under the podcast section, it's under Old School Bodybuilding. So go under Old School Bodybuilding. I think it's the first show we did. I interviewed Bob and a couple other guys from Chicago, Terry and Al, and they were giving some great stories about Sergio Oliva from the 60s. So check that out. This letter is from Lee. Lee says, hi, John. I hope all is well. Great interview this week with John Little. He had a lot of info about Mike Mensur and the backstory. Very well done. In terms of guests, have you tried Gary Stridham? He accepted my friend request on Facebook, and he talks a lot of politics, but it would be cool to hear him on your show in two parts, as well as Muhammad McAway. He's also started as a social media presence as well. As always, a stellar show. Yeah, I've contacted both of those guys. Gary has not gotten back to me. I've contacted him several times, and Muhammad doesn't contact me at all. I mean, I think Gary said he would do it, but then I've contacted him since then, and he's never said yes, so I haven't heard from him. I'll keep trying with him. McAway has not responded at all, so I'll just keep trying. This one, he said I could read his email, but he wants to remain anonymous, so I won't read his name. He says, "Hi, John. I just want to send a note about how much I've enjoyed listening to your podcast over the past several months. I sometimes use the Bodybuilding Legends website for the more comprehensive list, and at others, I subscribe to your YouTube channel, and I hear or see them that way. Let's just say that I'm a bit north of 60 years of age. I was an avid, amateur, non-competing bodybuilder in my teens and 20s. I got away from the sport for many years, and then on the heels of a substantial weight loss 5 years ago, I rediscovered the weight bug. The people you interview were often my heroes as a young man, and it's extremely nostalgic to bring back that old love of mine. For example, I grew up in Plymouth, Massachusetts, the home of Manuel Perry, known as Tweet Perry in his hometown, and I worked out in Backus Gym in Pembroke, Massachusetts, as my first gym. Remember many outstanding local bodybuilders from there, Len Archambault and Barry Blennis, and that's where I got started. In chiropractic school in Davenport, Iowa, I worked out at Joe's Gym in Moline, Illinois, where the most famous celebrity was Dale Ruplinger, who bought the gym and renamed it Universe Gym after he won the Mr. USA and then his classes at the America and the Universe. When I was working my hardest at becoming a bodybuilder, my absolute hero was Pat Neave. Later, when I first started my practice, I also did a bit of writing, and I had a couple of articles published by Bob Kennedy and Muscle Mag International. I love the Gary Bartlett stories on that podcast about working with Bob. Bob and my limited contact with him was a great guy. In any case, I want to tell you how much I appreciate your efforts at keeping the history of bodybuilding alive. And he says, John, I also see that you often... Oh, okay, so I didn't mention his name. That's what he was saying. All right, well, thank you for that email. And like I said, if you guys want to email me, just do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I'll read your letter on the air. We also did get an Apple Podcast review. I'm not sure if I read this last week. It was from July 4th. And he says, John does the best interviews on the golden era of bodybuilding. His knowledge of the subject is unparalleled. He also has great interviewing skills that allow his guests to relax and tell their stories. One subject I would love to see him cover would be a show on Serge Nubre. All right, there's another request for Serge Nubre. Due to Serge's strained relationship with the Weeders, there's not much known about his training and diet. All right. Thank you guys for your comments. I really do appreciate it. I'm glad we're getting so many comments on the shows. And that John Little interview was really popular, as was this last one we did with the 1980 Olympia. Let's see some future guests I got working on. I'm going to try and get Earl Menard, who was in the very first Mr. Olympia in 1965. So I'm hoping to get him. Rick Wayne, I'm still working on. Rick has promised to do the interview. He just won't give me a date. I'm trying to get Samir Benoot and Roy Callender together to do an interview, and they both said they would do it. We just got to find the time, so hopefully that'll be coming up soon. I've got Ed Connors hopefully coming up next week from Gold's Gym. He was one of the owners with Pete Kromkowski and Tim Kimber. So Ed should be a really fascinating interview. I'm looking forward to talking to him. And I was trying to get Jim Haislop, 1968 Mr. America, who lives right out here in Tampa, but unfortunately Jim was not going to do the interview by computer. He wants to do it in person. My video camera is not working. I had to wait for a friend of mine to get back from vacation with his family. He was actually out of the country. He was in Switzerland. So I had to wait for him to get back and ask him. He is finally back. But now I heard Jim is upset with me because I didn't get back to him right away. So I'm going to try calling him tomorrow and see if I can smooth that over. If not, then I guess we won't be talking to Jim Haislop, but hopefully he'll be understanding. All right. What else is going on? Oh, this week I got interviews with Muscular Development. They're going to be doing some stuff on Mr. Olympia history. So they're going to be talking to me and Peter McGuff about the Mr. Olympia contest from 1965 up to 1995. So that will be this week. So if you're a subscriber of Muscular Development or you look at them on YouTube, watch out for that interview. And I'm also supposed to be talking to Dave Palumbo again this week on RX Muscle. And we're going to talk about some Mr. America contest. So that should be interesting. So I will let you guys know next week if those interviews go through and if they're up. All right. So that's all I got. Here is our interview with 1980 and 1990 top amateur bodybuilder Gerard Dante, who went on to start his own supplement company, MHP. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have a very special guest with us this week, Mr. Gerard Dante, who was a big competitor in the 1980s before starting his own supplement company, MHP. Gerard, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good. Thanks for being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, I thought we would start off, Gerard, just talking about how you got into bodybuilding, what got you interested in lifting weights, and what got you interested in eventually competing.
Well, for me, you know, weight training actually started, my passion was really football. So, okay. You know, as a teenager, I really took a liking to training and, you know, I always kind of had aspirations for building muscle, but it was primarily to excel in athletics. So, you know, my focus back then was to train for football. You know, I played in high school, was an all-state football player. So that was kind of like my aspirations early on. And then, you know, as I was training, you know, back then, you know, you're talking about the, you know, when I started training young, I started training at like 13 years old, me and my best friend was the same age as me. And we basically converted his parents' garage, which they weren't happy with, but we actually converted it into a pretty cool little gym. We, saved all our allowances and all our birthday gifts and all our Christmas gifts were always, wow. You know, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we had the sand weights. I mean, you remember all that stuff, you know, yeah. So
this is like late 70s, right?
So let's see. So that was probably going back. Yeah. Early 80s, late 70s. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, So me and my childhood, you know, best friend, after school every day, we'd be in the gym training. Mm-hmm. We had a Lou Ferrigno poster hanging up and, you know,
right.
So that's where it all started, you know, so, you know, and then, again,
what did your body look like when you started training, Gerard? Cause you're a big guy. Did you have a good physique when you were in high school?
Yeah. Yeah. By time. Cause I started training at like 13. So just around, you know, so I responded pretty well. I responded pretty well to training. So,
okay.
I was always kind of, you know, thick, you know, muscular. So when I trained, you know, my body responded well. And I think that's one of the, you know, one of the primary things, you know, that I always usually tell people is that's why consistency is so important, because if you see progress, that's the motivation, right? The motivation really comes to the progress. So like a lot of times I tell people like, yeah, you know, give it your all, because, you know, as you give it your all, that's when you're going to see the progress. If you go 50%, then you're like, then you get discouraged because you're spending some time training, you're spending some time in the gym,
yeah.
And you're not getting the results you want. So you kind of like, you know, get discouraged. So, you know, I always tell people, especially, you know, younger kids, you know, with my son, you know, that was the thing with him. I told him consistency is going to be key for you. So, you know, that's important, you know? So again, it's right. the progress is the motivation behind it. So for me, you know, like you said, fortunately, I did respond. I mean, I had to work hard. I trained hard from a very early age. And then, you know, my passion was, again, football. And but as I started training, I remember then I went to my first gym was actually a very small gym. My town was in Cedar Grove. And, you know, gyms now are opened up all over the place, and they're 30,000 square feet, 25,000 right. square feet, 40,000 square feet. There were no gyms, right? So we had to actually drive, like, you know, we drove about a half hour. I went with my older cousin, and we would drive to the gym, me and a few of the guys, you know, from that were older than me in high school. And we drive down there, and it was a little gym called Liberto's. It was maybe 1,500 square feet. And, wow. You know, it was just filled. I was the youngest guy there, but it was primarily, you know, 18-year-old, 26-year-old guys. You know what I'm saying? Yep. And that was it. That was that was what the industry was back then.
Right, right.
But, you know, really quickly, within those few years, then smaller gyms started to pop up. Mm-hmm. And that's when you kind of started to see, you know, the movement of where people really started. And I think that's really when the industry started to grow. Yeah. In the, you know, the late 80s into the 90s. So, you know, I'm happy I actually, you know, did it during that time. Yeah. I think it was a good period of time.
Yeah, I tell some of these younger kids, they don't realize what it was like back then. You know, we had those small hardcore gyms that were independently owned. They weren't these big corporate, like you said, these big massive, gyms, fitness centers. And the atmosphere back then was so cool. You know, you walk in and like you said, it was all young guys, very serious training. Probably no cardio equipment, no TVs, right?
No cardio. Yeah, gym, the second gym I went to, the owners actually expanded. They opened another gym in Verona. It was called Olympia Gym.
Okay.
And the equipment was actually sprockets. It was like chain sprockets, you know, and it was like, you know, instead of pulleys, they used chains and sprockets, you know. Yeah, you had like one seated row, you know, one lat pull down, you know, a set of the dumbbells. We had one like stationary bike, but it was like the fan bike, like the front wheel was like the fan, you know?
Oh, yeah, the Airdyne one, right.
yeah. And nobody was ever on it, you know? Right, there was one guy I remember that always used to be on it, you know?
Yeah.
But that was it, you know? Right. And the back room was like, it was great because the back room was like the dungeon. It was like concrete floor, uneven, like, you know, divots in there. And that's where you went to do legs, you know?
Yeah.
So, it was a very, very different time.
What was your training like back then? You know, when you were in football and stuff, were you just training like 3 days a week and mostly basic movements?
No, you know, and that's where it kind of all started to evolve. So, you know, when I started to join the gym and I went into the gym, you know, there were a lot of guys that some guys were competitive bodybuilders, you know, early stage competitive bodybuilders. Mm-hmm. And you become, to be honest with you, I became a little bit obsessed with training. It's like, you know, you're a kid, you got all this energy.
Yeah.
Your body recovers and you're growing fast, right? So I probably overtrained, to be honest with you, but you know, I pretty much did like a sometimes 5-6 days a week, splitting up the body parts, you know. Back then I think I probably did like chest and arms together, mm-hmm. back by itself, shoulders, you know, and then legs, like a 4 day split and then repeat. So, you know, but I like to train heavy. I always enjoyed training heavy. And I incorporated a lot of, because of football, I did incorporate, you know, the deadlifts, some cleans and stuff like that.
Yeah. So when did your interest start revolving towards bodybuilding? You said you had that poster of Lou Ferrigno up. Were you following the bodybuilding scene back then?
I wasn't really following bodybuilding. I mean, Lou Ferrigno, he was the Incredible Hulk, and I was following that. And I did a little bit of the bodybuilding magazines, but not that much into it. You know, kind of it just evolved. Like I said, when I joined the gym, I saw some guys that were competing, and they would always tell me because my body was taking shape that, you know, they were older than me, but they're always be like, you know, you should compete, and I used to be like, forget about it. I'm not going on stage in my underwear and posing, you know. I'm here training for football.
Right.
And then it was like, then I'm seeing these guys compete and, you know, you kind of get, you know, I think I could do this, you know. And I decided to, the gym I was training at actually held a little private competition. So I decided to enter that. And then I went right into the New Jersey Teenage Championships.
Okay. How did you do there?
80, I won in 1986. I won the New Jersey
team. That's awesome. How many teenagers were in it? Because I remember back then the teenage shows were pretty tough.
It was loaded. It was loaded.
Yeah.
I mean, we had a good lineup of people. You know, Robbie Lopez was always, I don't know if you know Robbie.
Yeah, sure.
Bodybuilder. Uh-huh. He was always the guy in the middleweights, you know. Great physique. We had a few other guys that had, but the lineup, I mean, it was pretty deep back then.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see teenagers competing now.
No, it's amazing. If you go to a local show now, you're lucky if you get one or two, you know. I mean, I did the same thing. I competed in Chicago when I was a teenager. God, we would have at least 35, 40, 50 competitors, and teenage alone, it was amazing.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, no, it was pretty deep. So I actually, so I played 1 year at Montclair State University football.
Okay.
And then, like, it was right after that, I said, you know what, maybe I'm going to give bodybuilding a shot. And kind of, I kind of went in that direction, but thinking I would do both. Okay. And then I realized, you know what, let me just focus on bodybuilding. So I kind of evolved from there.
Yeah. So what was the feedback you got after that first teenage show? Because you do your first show and you win, and it's the Teenage New Jersey. Did the judges or anybody else, like, say, wow, you really got genetics for this? You got potential?
Yeah, you know, there was a good supportive group of people, the judges, you know, saying I had. And then you always had, you know, what was good is you always had some older guys.
Yeah.
You know, that were competing in the open division and, you know, encouraging you, you know, to continue. Actually, I have, you know, I got to also say I had a very good coach, Glenn Birkenkamp.
Okay.
Back then. So, you know, he was very instrumental in kind of, you know, determining like which, you know, which show, what was next.
Oh, okay, cool.
You know, the dieting, the training kind of, you know, guiding me in the right direction. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, so I was fortunate with that, had a good group of people, good group of friends that, you know, that were supportive of, mm-hmm. you know, of what I was doing.
Yeah.
Of course, my family was supportive.
Okay.
So, you know, all that helps.
Yeah. What was the diet like the first time when you dieted? Did you know what you were doing, or did you just like sort of get it from the magazines, or?
First I didn't really, you know, it was just kind of like, I knew I had to like cut out like all of it, cause I used to eat everything I wanted, you know, especially trying to, you know, get bigger for football. I mean,
yeah.
We used to actually, you know, I used to go down to the Jersey Shore in the summertime, and it was actually nice. There was a group of guys down there from all different towns. And they were all football players. So I got to make a lot of friends. And our thing was, at night, we would go down, we would basically go from, like, pizzeria to ice cream place. And we were just like, you know, every night it was like, how much can we eat to get heavier for the football season?
Those were days. You
know, yeah, so it was kind of an adjustment. And, you know, being Italian and having a mother that, you know, loves cooking and, you know, gets insulted if you don't eat all her food.
Right.
It made it a little bit tough. So. You know, my first diet, at first I was a little bit off, but then, like I said, then I started getting advice, and then Glenn Birkenkamp got involved and became very instrumental on, you know, I pretty much kept it with fish, chicken, potatoes, you know, I kept it pretty simple. I was never really never throughout my career was I really a low carb, you know, type of guy. I would sometimes do, you know, I would sometimes cycle my carbs lower.
Okay.
But I'm a big believer that, you know, to perform optimally and to get the calories that your body needs, you need, you need some carbohydrates.
As
Now, some people's bodies respond differently.
Yeah.
But for me, you know, I always felt better with the combination of just, you know, getting in the clean carbs, good sources of protein, keeping the fat, you know, low. And I was
I'm sure as a teenager, your metabolism had to be going really fast too, right? You probably needed those calories.
Yeah. I mean, I never starved on a bodybuilding diet.
Yeah.
I always, you know, I mean, actually in the off season, trying to eat clean was a challenge to get enough calories. You know, it was like, you felt like you were full all the time. That's why sometimes the off season is good.
Yeah.
It's good to, you know, cause you can only eat, you know, you can only get, when you're younger and you need to get in like 6,000 calories a day.
Right.
It's hard to do clean, you know.
Yeah, very hard. Yeah. So who was Glenn Birkenkamp? Was he a judge? Was he like a contest prep coach?
He was a judge. He helped a lot of people, you know, through the years. He helped a lot of, especially here in Jersey, you know, he helped John Natashak.
Okay.
Even a lot of the guys. He eventually went out to California, and he's still there, actually.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, and he helped a lot of the guys. Very knowledgeable.
Yeah.
Ahead of his time, actually, but then he just kind of, you know, stepped away from the scene.
Yeah. We just did a show about a month and a half ago about Bob Gruskin after he passed away, and I had, you know, John DeFendis and Jerry Scalise on here, and, you know, Tom Terwilliger, and they were all talking about how Bob helped them when they were teenagers, and he didn't even charge them money. He was just like telling them what shows to do and having them come over to his house and pose in his little mirror down in the basement, you know. And really push these guys to be great bodybuilders.
Yeah, Bob was very knowledgeable. Very knowledgeable. Yeah. had some good.
Amazing how different it was back then when you had people in the sport that were just willing to help young guys, you know, and without charging them money and stuff.
Yeah, they did. They had a love for the sport as well, you know. And
So
Glenn was still a dear friend of mine, so I still keep in touch with him.
Oh, great.
On a regular basis. Yeah, we had a lot of good memories together, a lot of fun together.
And,
fortunate, and you know, I'm glad that I'm still friends with him.
Yeah. So when did you do the team nationals? Was that the next year in 87?
Yeah, team nationals, I believe, was 87, yeah.
Okay. And you won the overall there in your first shot. Yeah. Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Who were you up against in that year? Do you remember?
Actually, Chris Cormier.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, again, that was the deep show, you know. Yeah. It was all the way out in Seattle.
Okay.
I went out to Seattle to compete. And, the show was deep. So, Robbie Lopez, who I mentioned, was in there, I believe. Chris Cormier was in there. And then, talking about, you know, so there was a lot of, from in those days, there was a lot more camaraderie, I think. I can only observe from the outside, right? So it's hard to say.
Yeah.
But I know, interesting. I follow these guys, you know, on some of the guys on the social media, and, you know, you see, you know, they still reflect back a lot. Like Chris reflects back a lot, you know, with his relationship with Flex Wheeler and Paul Gallet. I mean, you look at that era, and the talent, the depth of the talent, you know. Okay. And I think the guys now, I know there's a lot of controversy. I think the guys now that are on out there, the guys are good. I just think, you know, and I think they're, you know, but I just think the overall depth of talent, and I think it goes back to like when we were saying, just the number of competitors was larger. So I just think the depth of talent back then, when you went into a show, it was stacked. It was deep. So you would have a lot of guys that, you know, was very, very competitive. It's still competitive. And I know there's a lot of controversy about what era is better. It's always hard to compare one era to the next era. So I don't want to go there because I don't want, you know, these guys, I see these guys that are competing now and they train hard as well. You know, it's a different era. And these guys that are training, you know, are unbelievable. So, but I just think the era back then, from what I see, we were more, and I think part of it is because we were tighter knit because the gym environment wasn't commercialized.
Yeah, right? I agree. Yeah.
You got to remember when people used to ask me, like people used to look at me like I was crazy when I told them I train 5 days a week, right? They're like, you're in the gym 5 days. You know, but now everybody's in the gym. You know, people go to the gym, you know, to stay fit, you know. So it's become a way of life for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, we felt a closer bond because we were a little bit more unique at the time. Because idea of going to the gym every day wasn't the norm.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I wonder how much all these different classes they've added has maybe diluted the bodybuilding a little bit. And even like with the magazines, you know, we always had the magazines and that was a whole different perspective too, you know, compared to social media.
Well, I think one of the things that I think the expansion of the classes is good in a way, right? Because it gives a lot of people with different body structures and also different goals, right? Some people don't want to be 280 pounds. Some people can't be 280 pounds.
Right.
Well, it does give people a chance to have a goal to compete. But I think one of the bigger things that's taken away from bodybuilding is social media. Because I don't know if you remember, but the mystique of wondering how a guy was going to show up on competition day.
Yeah.
Right? Like now you look at these guys every day. So it's like, but you know, we used to wonder, you know, Lee Haney, like you don't get to see the only time you got to see the guy was in a magazine or on stage. Right. So, you know, now it's, you know, you're seeing these guys. So, you know, so often that you don't have, I don't think you have the wow factor as much.
Right.
Because,
right.
You know, you become desensitized to these, you know, to seeing it all the time.
Yeah, you would never see those guys at all unless they came to your town to guest pose or unless you went to the Mr. Olympia to see them, you know, because you would never see them. And all you would see them was in the magazine. So there was this big mystique about them. And I've had many discussions on this podcast about, you know, how special the magazines used to be and how we all used to wait for them. And, how you had to wait for the results like 3 months, you know, just to see who won the Mr. Olympia or whatever. So
yeah, exactly.
Totally different.
And, you know, and that was part of the motivation of doing well, was because if you did well, then you got that exposure. Right. So yeah. It was like, you know, now, you know, with social media,
yeah,
you know, the exposure comes everywhere. Right. It's like,
that's true. I mean, you had to win something to be in the magazines. Not anybody was just in the magazines. You had to earn your keep.
Yeah,
you know, earn your worth. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a little bit different. But you know, things change, things evolve, and you know, so it's just a little bit different now.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know.
So how'd you feel after you won the Teen Nationals? That had to be a huge victory. I mean, were those the only two teenage shows you did, the Teen New Jersey and the Teen Nationals?
I did the East Coast as well.
Okay.
And that one, I actually won the teenage and the open.
Wow. East Coast. Oh, so you started off strong then. You were winning everything.
Yeah. So yeah, it was a great feeling, and you know, it was the foundation of what really got me into bodybuilding.
Yeah.
You know, and then you know,
were you thinking about becoming a pro then at that point, Gerard? You know, because you won the team national.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I never did obtain the pro card. You know, but I competed in the USA a few times, took third. You know, it was competitive. It was competitive field. So
yeah,
you know, and then you know, 96 was the last time I competed. Was the North Americans?
Okay,
and that's kind of when I realized that, you know. I forget how old I was at that time, but maybe like 27, 28 years old.
Okay.
And, you know, I kind of realized that, you know, maybe, you know, try and figure out how to parlay my passion for the sport, you know, into some kind of other business venture
where,
you know, because as you know, to compete at that level, it's a commitment. It's a very big commitment. And I got to a point where I was like, you know, also got to start thinking about my financial well-being and, and so forth. So, you know, took a step away and kind of was fortunate enough where toward the end of my competing years, I was actually with Twin Lab. I was a sponsored athlete with Twin Lab.
Okay. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And quite honestly, you know, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed doing seminars for them, explaining to people about nutrition. Because when I competed, I always had to really personally focus on nutrition, you know, because I always felt like, you know, kind of, you know, give it my best shot, right? So, you know, some guys, you know, genetically, you know, better than I, so, you know, I have to be more in tune to my nutrition and supplementation. So I spent a lot of time personally, researching, different supplements, nutrition and all that.
Okay.
And when I was with Twin Lab, they were the biggest company at the time, pretty much.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember, but they were a big brand, you know, they had the Pro Fuel and the Rip Fuel and, you know, and, so, you know, it's kind of what got me to, you know, to understand the industry. Steve Bleckman, who was one of the family owners of the business, and was started by Mr. Bleckman, and then he had sets of twins as sons, and they ran the business.
Right.
But Steve Bleckman, was kind of like an inspiration to me as far as the, you know, how I saw, you know, how he was passionate about development of the products. And, you know, so I actually went to their facility a few times, and it was a very impressive manufacturing facility. And I used to talk to Steve a lot about, you know, about the products. Like I really, really took a passion for understanding that end of the industry and that end of the business. So that's what led me to, you know, to think about my own supplement brand. Cause I always, you know, when I was taking supplements, I would always read about things that weren't available. Like I would always read about nutrients and stuff that really wasn't available. Hmm. So, you know, my thought was, you know, pursue that. Let's see what I can do to make, you know, bring innovation, bring some things, you know, to the market.
Right. You said they had their own manufacturing plant where they were making their own supplements?
Twin Lab did, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's unusual, right? Most supplement companies don't have their own.
Most outsourced, especially now. Most outsourced.
Yeah. Okay.
So, but yeah, so, you know, so then, you know, I had some product ideas and I decided to form, you know, MHP, and that's okay. Really then all my focus and attention then went to, you know, the supplement side of the industry.
How long have you had that company now? When did you start it?
I founded it in 97. So like pretty much within 1 year after I had stopped competing.
Yeah.
Yeah, we developed a product. So, you know, we did, so Secretagogue 1, which was pretty much, you know, the first, you know, GH stimulating type product, it did well. And then we came out with, slightly after that, we did Track, which was really the first nitric oxide product. You know, now nitric oxide is a category.
Right.
The Track, which stood for time release arginine creatine, was pretty much the first product that people were instructed to take a pre-workout to help enhance your pump.
Right.
So Track was one of the products that helped put the company on the map, so to speak.
Okay.
And then we followed up with things like T-Bomb and, you know, and so forth.
That's interesting. So when you were competing, you were looking for products that had these different ingredients and they didn't have them. So then when you started your own company, you brought out these products.
Yeah. Yeah, I was always looking for, you know, research of what I could take, and I saw that there was a lot of interesting research out there, but products not yet available. That's really what really was my passion. That's what really created my thought process and founding MHP.
Yeah. So when you were in college, what were you studying?
Business and marketing.
Okay, gotcha. Because then I'm looking at your career. You also won the Collegiate Nationals overall, right? Or you won the heavyweight class?
Yeah.
So that's another big national title. And that was like, was that the year after the team nationals?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a big show. You know, those shows were bigger then. I'm not sure. I mean, I think they're still pretty big. I'm not sure how the team nationals, I mean, how the collegiate nationals is.
Yeah. I don't think it's as big as it used to be. Yeah. Because I think they hold it with the Masters. So it's like part of that whole weekend, you know,
okay.
When they have all those shows. What bodybuilders were you admiring back then, Gerard? Like when you won the team nationals team, because I know the year you won the team nationals, that's also the year Sean Ray won the nationals, and he was a young guy. He was only 22. Were you thinking now, next, I want to go up to that level, go up to the national level, and hopefully turn pro?
Yeah, you know, as I, when I first started competing, I wasn't really focused so much on bodybuilders so much, but
okay.
For sure there were some guys, Sean Ray, tremendous physique at the time and young and up and coming.
Yeah.
Eddie Robinson as well.
Yeah.
Many people don't remember, but there was a young guy shortly after me, I think maybe 2 years after me, but Shane DeMora. Do you remember Shane DeMora?
Yeah. He got his pro card at 19.
Yeah, yeah. Crazy. Glenn Bergenkamp worked with him as well, but he.
Oh, really?
You know,
okay.
Yeah, he, you know, he was a young guy, but some of the other guys, you know, I mean, back then there was, you know, the guys that were like the level ahead of me. You had, you know, of course there was, you know, Lee Haney. Lee Haney was the man back then.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you know, Gary Stridham was impressive. Like Barry DeMay had a great physique.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then you had the next round of impressive guys, you know, like, you know, then you had the Kevin Lavrones and that was kind of the mix of guys that I was competing against, you know, the Kevin Lavrones, the Fritz Wheelers, the, you know, Chris Cormier's.
Yeah. So you came up in an era, which was, everybody says now is probably the hardest era in bodybuilding, was the 90s. Cause that's when we had all this new influx of talent, you know, like you said. You had Lavrone, then you had Flex Wheeler, you had Chris Cormier, Mike Francois, all these great guys competing at the national level all at once.
Yeah. Paul DeMeo, Mike Matarazzo. It was deep, you know.
Yeah. So what did you do after the Collegiate Nationals? You did the Junior Nationals?
No, I didn't do the Junior. I just did a few. I went, competed in the USA a few times.
Okay.
And then I did the North America. So there was like a few years where I think it took a year or two off.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because around that time, I think they were kind of changing it, where if you won your class at the Nationals or the USA or the North America, you could turn pro. Those were the three big ones.
Right? Yeah, those were the three qualifiers, exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So how many years did you compete then on that national level, Gerard?
Well, in total, so 86 was the first year I competed, 96 was the last year I competed, so 10 years.
10 years, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So what was your experience like doing that? Were you disappointed you weren't getting your pro card? Or, man, I know it was like super tough. It was very competitive.
Yeah, of course, definitely. I mean, you're always, you know, you're shooting for something, right? So, you know, you're disappointed if you don't, you know, you don't achieve that goal. But right. Looking back, you know, I have a lot of memories. You know, a lot of good memories, a lot of good times. You know, I went into every show, you know, gave it all I had. So I don't have regrets, you know, some disappointment. Yeah. But yeah. You know, no regrets.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, what can you do? That was a very tough lineup. You were also making a lot of magazine covers at that time too, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So they liked your look and you're getting the magazine coverage.
Yeah, yeah, I was fortunate that I got a lot of good exposure in the magazines. They gave me a lot of coverage.
Yeah. Are there any shows that you were doing back then that stand out, like where you had some really tough competition or some of the guys you competed against?
Specifically, like each show, I don't remember. But, yeah, I mean, there were shows when, you know, we had all in one lineup would be, you know, Flex, Laverone.
Yeah.
The Mayo. You know, all these guys in one lineup. So, you know, we were, you know, when you go, when you're backstage, you know, you look around, it was deep. And you really didn't know a lot, you know, and then a lot of times you had surprises. Like Phil Hernon, one year, nobody really had him on their radar.
Yeah.
And, you know, he came in looking unbelievable. I mean, the guy was thick as hell. And everybody was like, wow.
Yeah, even today when you look at pictures of him, he was like so impressive for back then.
Yeah, you know, and so... Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So, you know, it was always hard to predict because, you know, the lineup was deep, and then sometimes you would even get, you know, you also had great bodybuilders who didn't achieve their card, like, you know, Edgar Fletcher. I mean, that guy was phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, and he was always in the mix. So it was.
Yeah, that's another big difference from today, from back then, was you had to, like, really, really be really great to get your pro card because there were so many guys left behind, you know. Because there's only a few opportunities to get it. You had to win. You had to take first place.
Yeah, that was it, you know. So
I think in North America, you had to win the overall, right? You couldn't just win your class. I think you had to win the overall.
I think the USA back then, or it had to be overall for the USA and the North America.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Or you had to win your class.
The Nationals was the class.
Right, right. Yeah, that's amazing. You were in that 91 then Nationals, right? When they had that super big lineup with Ronnie Coleman and Lavroni and Flex and all those guys?
I wasn't in the Nationals that year. I did did the Junior Nationals that year and took third to DeMayo and Lavrone took second.
Okay.
And then I was kind of burnt out because I did the USA, which was usually in like June.
Yeah.
And I went on to the Junior Nationals and I was contemplating, should I do the Nationals or not do the Nationals? But I didn't. But that lineup was you know,
insane.
It was like an Olympia. It was like an Olympia lineup.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I think you had what? Matt Mendenhall was fifth, right?
Yeah. Ronnie.
Ronnie was fourth. DeMayo was third, right? Flex was second, and that's the year that Laverne won, right?
Right. Yeah, one of the best Nationals ever, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So how was the industry back then in bodybuilding? Were you able to make a living from bodybuilding, even though you weren't a pro, because there were so many other opportunities like seminars and you said you were working for Twin Labs and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't live luxuriously as a bodybuilder, you know.
Right.
And, you know, the guys that maybe were, at that time, the guys that were, you know, maybe in the top 10 of the Olympia could probably make a living.
Yeah.
But otherwise it was tough. You know, then you had the WBF came in, I think around 91.
Yeah. 91.
Right.
91, 92.
And that kind of changed, you know, changed the economic opportunities for bodybuilders temporarily because they were handing out some nice contracts, which then also raised the value, you know, for the IFBB and the prize money and the other opportunities. Yeah. So, but you know, there was the sponsorship opportunities, I think, were were probably better then for athletes, because now I think with the what's happening with the oversaturation of social media, I think athletes' opportunities to align themselves with a brand were a little bit stronger.
Yeah.
Back then.
You had to be a competitor. You had to be a good competitor as well as having a good look, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're definitely, and again, there was guest posing opportunities. But not as, I don't know. I don't think there was enough, unless you were one of the guys that were, like I said, up in the top 10 of the Olympia. Mm-hmm. Really not enough available out there to earn a good living. You can get by, and if this is your passion and this is what your focus is,
right?
You can probably get by, and this is and your life is about bodybuilding,
right?
But
yeah. So when you started MHB, when you started their supplement company, how did you go about doing that? Because I know that a lot of people, especially today, they want to get into the supplement business. And I see more and more bodybuilders trying to do that. You were probably one of the first competitive bodybuilders to start that, because you started way back in the 90s. So your company's been going for over 20 years now, and you're still doing it successfully. So how did you get – what was the whole basis on getting started in that?
Well, like I said, I had an idea for a product formula, which was the Secretagogue. So I was pretty fortunate. So I went to a contract manufacturer with my idea.
Okay.
And explained to them what I wanted, and they started to produce some prototypes, and we finalized the formula.
Okay.
And then I was kind of lucky in the fact that because I was a competitive bodybuilder, the industry was a lot smaller. So, you had GNC and Vitamin Shoppe were, your predominant players as far as, sales and distribution go.
Yeah.
So, I was lucky in that, when I reached out to GNC, the buyer knew who I was and did like the concept of the product, because it was different. It was something they didn't have. So they took the product in, and, you just become a very good listener, and you listen to their suggestions. And, I was doing advertising in the magazines. I had some good that was helpful as well, because I had good relations with the magazine owners, because of my time I had been working in the magazines,
right?
Competitor, so had some relations there, understanding how I needed to market the products and stuff. So
okay.
I think that was all all very helpful to me. So Secretagogue, had taken off, and then from there. 2 years after, I had come up with the track formula, which was unique at the time, the time-released arginine creatine, and that would ended up being successful. And I just kept reinvesting into the company, and coming up with new product concepts, and just kept building. And and then I started Muscle Meds in 2007, which has grown into another pretty, sizable brand itself. And again, the primary product there is our carnivore beef protein. So,
okay.
So we basically created a whole new category in protein with a beef protein, being able to deliver, highly concentrated beef without the fat, without the cholesterol.
Oh.
And so now we have a full line of, carnivore. Carnivore, carnivore mass, carnivore shred, which is a fat-burning beef protein, carnivore RTD. So we've expanded. It's the number one selling beef brand in the world. So it's taken off.
When you started that, were there a lot of those? Was that one of the unique ones for beef protein? Was that the?
Yeah, nobody was. Yeah, nobody kind of. But when I came across the source of supply, I knew right away that people understand beef and muscle, right?
Right.
We know you eat steak, so it was to me, it was like, people understand this. So, so I worked with the raw material supplier to refine the product as much as possible to get it to mix and taste as palatable as possible. Got it to, you know, we actually got it so pure that it's very clean tasting. Like, you know.
Wow.
So then, you know, we launched that and, you know, it turned out to be a huge success. So we just continue to expand, you know, expand upon it.
So basically you just started with one product and you came out with a product that was not well known to the industry. It wasn't being available, you know, the growth hormone secreting product. And then that took off and then you just expanded from there. You just came up with new products and just kept, like you said, kept reinvesting into the business.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, I mean, the key for us had always been, quite honestly, especially, you know, coming into an industry, you know, we were a startup, obviously. And, you know, there were some sizable, you know, players. So for me, I always looked at, you know, you have to be innovative, like to try and copy somebody.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you really have to come in there and bring something new, something innovative, something that has an added value to the consumer.
Right.
That's always been my philosophy, you know, trying to fill the gaps with something innovative.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense because you see so many of these bodybuilders who just want to get into the supplement industry, but they'll start out with like a whey protein, a creatine, you know, the same basic stuff that everybody has. And
exactly.
And then they're going into an industry that's just so competitive. It's how are they ever going to make it, you know?
Exactly. So that's, you know, I think that's the common mistake a lot of people make. You know, the industry, especially now, you know, because it's so competitive. There's so much out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, the key, especially now, is really to get, you know, bring some innovation, bring something different.
Yeah. How about the marketing of the products now compared to when you started, Gerard? I mean, were you trying to get into the magazines back then to advertise it? And then, of course, you had to probably get into Vitamin Shoppe, like you said, and GNC in order to really make any sales, right?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it's very different because back then a lot of it was driven by the magazines, for sure.
Yeah.
And that's where people were getting their information on bodybuilding and supplements. You know, we didn't have the internet quite as much. You know, bodybuilding.com came onto the scene, and we had a great relationship with them, and we were very successful with them, and that helped because, you know, once online became popular, that's where people then began to search for products or articles. So, you know, but now it's very different because now it's, you know, online purchases are a lot higher and people are, you know, looking on to buy things online or looking for information online. So the dynamics of the marketing has changed, you know, considerably.
Yeah. So how are you marketing now? How are you marketing your products now with the change?
A lot of digital, you know, digital marketing, you know, getting the messaging out. Yeah. So I think that's, you know, that's kind of been the shift, you know, it's kind of, you know, been the shift. And I think now more than ever to sustain, you know, the innovation is important, but then also maintaining the quality of the products. That's
good.
You know, recruiting and getting the customer is one thing, but it's the customer retention.
Yeah.
Exactly. Keeping my customer.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's what's going to create longevity.
Right. Do you have athletes represent your product? Like, I know that was a big thing back in the 90s. Do you do that still?
You still do. I mean, you know, Victor Martinez has been with my company since 2005.
Okay. Yeah.
And he's still, you know, so he's, yeah, you know, so then we have Akeem Williams.
Okay.
We have Nicholas Balud. So we still have a few athletes. We have Julius Maddox, who just, you know, is the world's strongest bencher.
Great.
So, yeah, so we, you know, we try and get different athletes from different sports.
Yeah.
So.
What about the expos and stuff? Is it important to make a presence known there, you know, when they have the Olympia Expo or the Arnold Expo? I know that used to be a real big thing. Is that changing now with social media taking over more?
Yeah, I think they've also lost their impact for a number of reasons. I mean, kind of. One of the good things about the expos, I think people still want to see, you know, if the athletes are there, they want to see them live.
Yeah.
But I think it's not as much of a need anymore because people are following these people.
See them every day online. Yeah.
And then also, as far as the products go, you know, trade shows was really where you were launching new products, right?
To get it,
the exposure. Now, you know, you could do a much better job online announcing the launch of a new product
than
at an expo.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's changed a lot.
Yeah. Are you worried at all about this coronavirus, how it's going to affect expos in the near future? I mean, you wonder, are people going to be able to, are going to be hesitant about going into a crowded place like that?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think for a while people are going to be concerned. I mean, I think people are still, people are still unsure where this is going to go. You know, we're going to have a resurgence. You know, yet there's so much. There's so much mixed messages and mixed information. You know, you can catch it from touching something. You can, when this whole thing started, it was like, you had to take all your clothes off before you went into the house and last on your clothes for 2 weeks.
Right.
So who really knows, you know?
Yeah.
And then you hear, it's not contagious from this way or that way. And so, so I think,
don't wear a mask, then wear a mask. You know, you're right. It's different messages coming all the time.
Yeah. So, but I think, with that, I think people have concerns. I think, a lot of the media definitely paints it as dangerous. I don't think we all really know how dangerous it is, but, but I think people will be less comfortable going into crowded places and looking to avoid crowded places. How long that's going to be, people do have a tendency to forget over time and ease up. I mean, I see it in myself and I see it in people in general, when this first happened, like I was conscious not to shake people's hands. Like now, now it's like, so it's, we'll see.
Yeah.
But absolutely. I do think it'll affect the up and coming expos.
Yeah.
And we'll see where it goes from there.
Yeah, I know they put the Olympia in December, which I think they tried to put it as far back as possible to make sure that hopefully the stuff will dissipate. But, I hope that goes off. You know, it would be incredible if they didn't have an Olympia or if they didn't have an Olympia Expo. That would be unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, like they had to do with the Arnold is they canceled it and they just had the athletes compete,
Yeah,
so.
That's true. Yeah, with no audience.
Very different, So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I hope for the industry that it takes place, and more so I hope for the athletes as well.
Yeah.
Because, this is what they do for a living, and this is what they spend a lot of time, it's obviously nice for them to be able to compete in front of their fans.
Yeah. Yeah, even the amateur athletes who were all getting ready for contests at the beginning of the year, and then they had to just let it go, They don't know either whether they're in shape or hope for later on in the year. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, listen, it impacted everybody's lives, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Everywhere.
My two twins are seniors, So
they couldn't be.
Yeah. So, they missed like the whole end of their senior year. And so,
Yeah.
So, it impacted everybody in many ways.
Absolutely. So what do you guys got planned for MHP in the future, in the near future? Any new products or?
Actually, we just came out with this, the Anadrox Pump and Burn.
Okay.
So this is a little bit different in that, we've always had a capsule Anadrox Pump and Burn and it does very well, but with a powder, you can obviously get a larger dose load.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pre-workout that, gives you energy, gives you good muscle pumps. And has a very high thermogenic effect because we got like a good dose of grains of paradise in there, green tea. So you could actually feel your body temperature when you take it. You can actually feel the heat sensation.
Oh, okay.
Which as you know creates thermogenesis, and so it's kind of like a fat burning like pre workout.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so we're pretty excited about that. We're working on some other interesting innovations. That'll be coming out. We have with both brands, so probably within the next few months you'll see some other new product releases for both brands. With MuscleMeds, we just relaunched a pre-workout as well called
Test. Yeah, that's a big part of the industry now, right? The pre-workouts that wasn't around really years ago.
Yeah, I mean, pre-workout is next to protein pretty much.
Yeah,
pre-workout's it, and then obviously you have your then you have your amino acids. So it's probably those three categories seem to be about the majority of
Of the
basically breakdown of categories.
Yeah.
Test boosters still do pretty good, you know, fat burners, but for the most part, it's pre-workout, proteins, gainers, especially in some markets.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Those used to be big.
Yeah, I mean, we do, you know, we do very well with our Up Your Mass, and then that's our MHP gainer. We do really well with that. And then you have Carnivore Mass with Muscle Mass.
Oh, okay, cool. How's your training going today? Are you still in the gym regularly? Or?
Yeah. So obviously with COVID, I've been training at home.
Yeah.
I still train, you know, four to five times per week.
Yeah.
Not crazy heavy anymore, you know. Had total shoulder replacement in my right shoulder.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I need it in my left shoulder. So I'm kind of restricted in what I can do.
Yeah.
But, you know, working my way around it. How about you?
Yeah, I'm still going pretty heavy. I'm out here in Florida. So we opened up the gyms. I think it's been about a month now. So we got pretty lucky. I think we were one of the first ones to open up again, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I keep forgetting that other parts of the country are still closed down, you know.
Our gyms are still closed, so
wow.
Sometime hopefully in July.
Yeah, everybody's got to be going nuts because I know people are going nuts here. The first day they opened up, it was like July 2nd. You know, it was packed. Everybody was in there.
Is there no restrictions? Full capacity they can open to?
Yeah, there's such a big gym. You know, they have social distancing, but they don't really have to limit the amount of people coming in because the gym is so big. And I noticed, like, when they first opened up, a lot of people were wearing masks. But now they're not doing that so much because I think you can't breathe, you know, when you're working out. So,
yeah, I don't do well with those masks.
Yeah, me neither. I hate those things, yeah. So I know more cities are requiring it now when you go out.
Yeah, right.
Because I know it is going, like, in Florida, the cases are going way up again. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. You think, how about like with the machines wiping down? Are people a little concerned about
that? Yeah, they're really on that, you know. In fact, Sunday night they had somebody professional come in and spray everything down, you know. So, but yeah, they're telling everybody, make sure every time you use anything, a bar, a bench, or a machine, you know, wipe it down. So they got the stuff all over the place. So that is one thing that's really changed. They've really been doing that a lot.
Yeah. Who would have thought, right?
Oh, man, what a crazy year. Well, Gerard, I want to thank you for joining us on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I've seen your physique competing for many, many years, and I never got a chance to talk to you, so it was great meeting you. And congratulations on the success with your two companies. I know you guys have been around the industry a long time, so you're doing really great with that.
Well, thank you very much. Very nice speaking with you.
All right. We'll talk to you again. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank Gerard Dante for joining us. I also want to thank Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank all my Patreon donors who continue to support the website and the podcast by donating money to us each month. I appreciate you guys. If you're interested in being a Patreon donor, you can just go to the bodybuildinglegendsshow.com website and it'll be right there in the upper right-hand corner. Thank you for considering that. Before we go, I want to read this article from the October 23rd, 1974 issue about Sports Illustrated, and it's about the 1974 Mr. Olympia. This is really awesome. I think this is probably the first time and probably the only time that Sports Illustrated, which was the major sports magazine in America at that time, around the world, they covered a bodybuilding contest, Mr. Olympia. So let me read this. It's called Trying to Muscle In. Practice Makes the Perfect Man. He's still Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it's written by Barry McDermott. Even the sharpest perception is dulled by the maelstrom of New York City, a place where an extravaganza is as common as wingtips at the Rotary Club. But last week, many blasé New Yorkers were gagging on their sequins and denim cool, gaping like tykes at a circus at the sight of the huge men strutting about Madison Square Garden. The Giants were there for a showdown. Not with fists or guns or even with basketballs, but with muscles. The occasion was the Mr. Olympia contest stage at the Garden's Felt Forum. It was a bodybuilding competition among the world's most muscular and best developed men, and their talent was obvious.
No bad calls by umpires, no upset stomach, no poor footing could induce a slack performance. It was all there on the posing stand. The symmetrical result sculpted through tedious, agonizing, and seemingly endless hours of pumping iron in dank gymnasiums, and it was appreciated by a coterie of zealous fans. The objects of esteem were four men at the zenith of their sport, athletes so far advanced that even their colleagues regard them with envy and awe. They were Arnold Schwarzenegger, going for his fifth consecutive Mr. Olympia title, enough of a legend for his first name to evoke a response whenever a barbell is picked up with purpose. Lou Ferrigno from Brooklyn, even bigger than Arnold, but young, entered in his first professional contest. Franco Colombo, short and compact, whose misfortune it is to be performing in the same era as his friend Schwarzenegger. And Frank Zane, like Arnold and Franco, a Californian, also a school teacher and one of the few ever to defeat Schwarzenegger. That victory was back in 1968 in a Mr. Universe contest. Ferrigno was the subject of speculation and curiosity, the rookie who looked good during the spring, but could he hack it in the major leagues? He is 6'5", weighs 265, and at 22 years old is regarded as the heir to the champion. The two had never met, and just a few days before the contest, Ferrigno wondered about the wisdom of challenging Schwarzenegger, the Austrian Oak. If Ferrigno did and lost, the appearance in the Garden would cost him his amateur status, and he would become a wandering minstrel with nowhere to play his tune. On Wednesday, Matthew Ferrigno, who was a lieutenant in the New York City Police Department and Lou's father, said, "If Arnold were here, we could decide, but Arnold don't show himself to nobody." The champ was still in Los Angeles. The next day, young Ferrigno appeared at a press preview, and after a session under the warm lights of television cameras, the brooding giant made his decision. He would meet Schwarzenegger. "I've been waiting 8 years for this day to come," he said in a heavy Flatbush accent. "The Olympia is the most prestigious class in the world. If my son wins, he will hold the title for a decade," the lieutenant noted proudly. "There is nobody on the horizon to challenge him." The dark, busy-haired Ferrigno, who for the moment has put aside his career as a sheet metal worker, had just won his second Mr. Universe title in Verona, Italy, and he was on a six-hour-a-day, six-day-a-week training schedule and a strict diet. Criticism of his legs was driving him to lift 600 pounds 15 to 20 times a day to improve his calf muscles. His detractors said he still lacked the definition of muscle essential to achieve top ranking in the sport. The ability was there, but the polish was missing. Ferrigno is massive, but so is Schwarzenegger, and the Oak's muscles jump out at you like outrageous price tags. "Lou can't even beat me," said Colombo, his voice accented with scorn. "He lacks experience in a few body parts, like a back and calves. When he stands with Arnold, he looks bigger because he is bigger. He looks impressive, but when they pose, Arnold's experience wins out. An amateur will be up against a professional." Colombo is competing with Frank Zane in the small class of the Mr. Olympia, the category for men weighing less than 200 pounds. There would be individual class winners plus an overall champion, but it was obvious that Colombo considered the major title beyond his reach. Why then was he here? "The main thing is not to win the contest," he answered. "I have a very good following. They expect a good show." Just then, a skinny teenager walked up and plaintively asked the secret to gaining weight. It was like badgering Nolan Ryan about how to pitch a fastball. "I have a booklet about that," Colombo said. He peddles booklets explaining his training secrets. They sell for $2. Schwarzenegger gets $3 for his. On Friday, Colombo and Schwarzenegger appeared on a morning television show. Ferrigno was not there. "He is probably sitting at home watching my body and moving around his television set, posing to see if he should compete," said Schwarzenegger. "I want to go against Ferrigno because he's new and people are talking about him." Both Schwarzenegger and Colombo are considering retirement. The Oak is only 27, but he's weary of competition, or perhaps the lack of it, and he hinted that this could be his last contest. Colombo, who claims to be 30 but maybe older, is attending chiropractic school. He intends to go into business. When the competition began, it was immediately evident that Colombo would defeat Zane and win that class. Next to the dense, muscular Italian, Zane looked almost willowy. That left the champ and the challenger. The crowd responded with wild shouts of encouragement as Schwarzenegger and his young opponent took the stage. Spotlights and oil highlighted their muscles. As they moved through their poses, Schwarzenegger's superiority began to show. At one point, they turned and found themselves face to face, both locked in arm shots. veins popping and foreheads glistening, their bodies trembling with effort. Schwarzenegger looked at Ferrigno and smiled as if to say, "You are beaten." It was a boxer psyching his opponent, and the crowd knew it, and so did the judges. Once more, Arnold Schwarzenegger was Mr. Olympia. Later, as he walked down the crowded streets of the city, people turned and stared unabashedly at him. Tykes at a circus. The end. All right. Great article by Barry McDermott in Sports Illustrated. Thank you to Pat Comer for sharing that. That was awesome. I love reading that stuff. Really well written. You can tell this guy was a great writer. And like I said, just great stuff where bodybuilding was covered by the mass media. The good old days of bodybuilding. All right, guys, that's it for our show. Thank you for listening. We will see you next week. Hopefully we'll have Ed Connors from Gold's Gym on the show with us. Have a great week. Be safe out there and take care.